Welcome to the DMSG Healthcare Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Hadley, founder and CEO of the Denver Medical Study Group. Our organization was founded in November of 2008, and we're going into our 15th year this year. We have over 1,250 members in 29 states, including Colorado. This year, we'll meet both on DMSG webinars and in person, which is a little different from the last 3 years, so we're excited about that. Thank you for listening to our DMSG Healthcare Podcast. These interviews give us the opportunity to share stories of healthcare leaders around the country. I'm excited to visit today with Doug Jackson, PhD, JD, and CEO and President of Project Cure, with its international headquarters here in Denver. Doug, thanks for joining me today. Would you tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and your background?
Well, thanks, Chris, and congratulations on the growth of the Denver Medical Study Group. It's just been really exciting to be a part of it and what you're doing for the medical community, not only here in Denver and along the Front Range, but you know, you've got national reach, and that's a pretty cool thing. So congratulations for that.
Thank you.
You know, it's kind of a funny thing that we would be talking about a medical group, because my background is not medicine. I've got a juris doctor. I'm an attorney, and I practiced for a while. Got into mergers and acquisitions and went back and got a PhD in finance, thinking I was going to go do hedge funds or private equity or something. And my dad, interestingly, made his money developing ski areas west of Denver and just figured out that you could be rich and not happy. So they gave their money away, and that really was the genesis of Project Cure and how we got started. And so I told my pop I'd help him for 6 months, and you know, that was 25 years ago. So here we are working to change the world. We deliver medical relief into about 138 countries around the world, and ship about 5 semi-truck trailers every week. And everything we do is donated. And so we just give away everything from catheters to CAT scans, needle syringes, gloves, gauze, beds, all of the things that you can imagine. And yeah, and we just deliver it.
You know, it's always interesting to talk to you. I never know where you are. You're either in Denver, or you're in Washington, D.C., or you're in some other country. And so you do quite a bit of traveling, but I have a question for you that comes to mind when I think of the name of your organization, Project Cure. Do the letters C-U-R-E stand for anything in particular related to your organization's mission?
It's the Commission on Urgent Relief and Equipment. And so the relief is the consumable items, and medical equipment is, I mean, obviously medical equipment. The idea is that there's people who are going to die because they don't have access to anything from, you know, suture to x-rays. And we've got it here in such abundance that we waste it here. So we're just in the process of picking all of that urgent relief and equipment up and shipping it overseas.
Well, I've always wondered what if CURE stood for anything, and I appreciate you explaining that. As you mentioned, your father started this business. I think it's in its 36th year now, and you've been around for, you say, what, 25 years of that time period?
Yeah, I came on after he'd run it for about 10 years, and I committed I'd help him for 6 months, and here we are.
What did Project CURE look like 25 years ago when you took it over?
Well, it was a different organization. I think we had worked in about 35 countries, and we would ship about one container every week. And we had about 12 volunteers. So today we have about 35,000 volunteers. Like I said, we do about 5 containers. Our total top line that year was about 100,000, and this year we're edging in on 100 million. So it's grown a bunch. It's grown a bunch.
It sure has. Recently, we had a DMSG event with guest speaker Dr. Brian Wong out of Seattle.
Yeah.
Talking about culture and the importance of it to the success of an organization. How have you built the culture of Project Cure over the last 20, 25 years?
Well, it's interesting because we have about 1,000 volunteers per one paid staff. And to really think through that whole thing, you know, is pretty important. I you know, we talk a lot about passion and purpose and all of those things. And I think that the idea that I aspire to is that people really connect your passion with your purpose. There's a lot of folks that want to go out and pursue their passion. You know, mine would be racing cars. I'd love to be a professional car racer or a chef. That would be fun. But, you know, unless you line those things up with something that really matters, you're in trouble. And I think that everybody has a purpose. You got a reason to be here. That may or may not be your passion at the beginning. But if you use your purpose to serve other people, you would develop a passion around that. And so we have really tried to be. In fact, the first question I ask on any interview is, so tell me what gets you up and out of bed, your feet on the ground, ready to take on the world. That's a passion question. What are you driven to do, right? And that will also get to be the purpose. And then what I'm looking for is I'm looking for somebody to say, you know, I really want to help people. We had hired a woman who grew up literally in poverty in Mexico. And she said, you know, we weren't that poor. She said, we could go down to the river and do our laundry. And I'm thinking, well, that's pretty poor in my book. And her passion and her purpose was, I want to serve other people because I was given so much in my life. I want to give back. And that's a straight A answer in my book. So the first part about that culture, Chris, is to really focus our culture on the people who are passionate to serve other people. And that's their purpose to be on the earth. And if you can align those three things, you can build some pretty amazing things around that. And then we talk about the fact that it's absolutely impossible to over-communicate. You know, to be able to get 1,000 people lined up and going in the same direction. And by the way, you know, these are volunteers. I tell people, everybody gets paid, right? Just not everybody gets paid in cash. And so for a lot of these folks, you know, what they get paid in is their heart gets full. They have purpose. They're serving their passion. They're helping other people. And when they get paid in stories. They want to know, how did we impact Ukraine? They want to know, what did we do about the civil war in Ethiopia? They want to know what we did in a little village town in Guatemala. What are we doing about Cuba? And, you know, what were we doing in India? All these places like that. So I've become the chief storytelling officer of this organization because that's how my volunteers get paid, frankly.
Wow. Well, I know with all that you've done in what, the 135 countries that you provide medical equipment and medical support to, you also have had a significant impact here in our own country, especially during this past 2 years, 3 years with the pandemic. How did that impact your efforts here?
Well, you know, it's interesting because the donors to Project Cure, and I'm talking about hospital systems, big medical companies, they really, for lots of reasons, a big one is legal. They really don't want us distributing these products in the United States. I mean, the worst thing that would happen is for a hospital chain to donate a mammography machine and to a little inner city health clinic. And you know, if a woman gets a bad outcome, somebody's going to get sued. And so we're just that litigious society. So usually we agree that everything that we get from Hillrom, Stryker, whoever, Baxter, Medline, we're going to give that away, not in this country. And so that's part of what we've got on our plate. But March 11th of 2020, President Trump shut down the borders. We were looking at this COVID thing. And I started getting calls from like my brother, he's fire chief here in Denver. And he says, can we come by and pick up PPE? I said, sure. Why do you need PPE? And he says, because we're out. We don't have any more. I'm like, you're the fire department. You can't be out of gloves and masks and gowns. Come on, guys. And he said, no, he said, we're gloving up, masking up everybody. And he said, we've run out. Well, the next call we got was from one of our volunteers who works at a local hospital here. And she says, you know, we're gowning up in plastic trash bags. Can we come to Project Cure and get a few things? So we put together some pallets and, you know, a couple of those calls. I called Chris Anderson, who's my vice president here. And he and I jumped on the phone, and we didn't even call the board, which is probably not a great example for other CEOs listening, you know, but we just decided, man, we got to do something. We got to take care of these people. And so we went through the warehouse and we pulled off all the gloves and gowns and masks that we could find and turned our trucks around. And instead of collecting stuff from the hospitals, we started putting things into the hospitals. We put a bunch of ventilators out at University of Colorado Anschutz. We got introduced to a guy named Ben Anderson, who's with the Colorado Rural Hospital Association. And you know, Ben starts calling from little towns like Holyoke and just said, hey, there's a guy on a ventilator, and the ventilator just went down. So we found a group called Angels Flight. We put a ventilator in the back of one of these little beach crafts, whatever it was, Cessna, and flew it out there. And they picked that thing up, drove it to the hospital, plugged it in. It worked, saved this guy's life. And we spent the better part of our COVID experience doing some pretty crazy stuff like that and really serving our community. And then, you know, Chris, it was the weirdest thing. About the end of November of 2020, literally, it was like somebody reached over and turned the light switch off. We stopped getting requests. The hospitals in Denver were like, in Nashville and Houston and Phoenix and all the other places we were working, it was kind of like they just had enough and they didn't need the stuff anymore. So we spent about 3 days or so calling everybody saying, hey, you know, you guys need new N95s. Nah, we're good. And that's when we kind of knew it was time for us to pivot back and start working in the developing world again. Stryker, it was kind of a funny story. They called up and they said, hey, we manufactured these hospital beds for COVID. You remember the early days of COVID, we thought that we were going to have to turn all of our shopping centers and convention centers and all of that into triage places. And people were going to have to go to the hospital in the shopping mall, you know? So Stryker manufactured this bed for COVID. And, you know, it's a metal bed. It's got a hard pan so you can do compression on it if you need to. You know, the bottom of it doesn't have springs. It's got a metal pan. It's got wheels. It's got a headboard, a footboard. It articulates so you can actually ventilate in this bed. IV pole, brand new mattresses. Stryker said, hey, do you guys want some of these beds? You know, the cities never took possession of them. And I said, sure, absolutely. And they said, well, you know, they're manual, right? And they said, yeah, that's great for us because we're going to places around Africa, for example, that don't have any power. So that's terrific. By the way, how many beds do you have? And Liz, the little the woman that we're working with in Kalamazoo, Michigan, at Stryker, Liz says, well, we've got 22,500 beds. And I said, wow, that's a lot of beds. Turns out by the time we got done, we moved 25,000 brand new beds and mattresses. We put 1,500 of them into Ukraine. They're in, and I mean, I just, it was such a fun deal. We couldn't be more proud of Stryker giving us those beds. And, you know, and we still get electric beds from Neil Rahm and, you know, all different kinds of people. But that was a big, big deal.
Yeah, you know, and thinking about your organization is a nonprofit organization, and it appears, as you have shared today, that the employees and the volunteers do what they do because they're motivated by mission first. How have you managed to run a nonprofit like a business and at the same time manage the culture with employees who feel called to serve an international mission with a worldwide impact?
Yeah, we tell a lot of story here. We just had a all teams call today. Every other week, we get everybody on a Zoom call. We started that actually during COVID and we did it on Fridays during COVID. And I wanted to tell everybody, you know, that we were raising money and that this is what was going on. You guys can go home and know that you have a job on Monday. Because people were freaking out, you know, during COVID. And we just thought that was a pretty cool practice to get all of us together Weekly was too much, so we went bi-weekly, and we decided to start doing them on Mondays so that we could set the tone for the next 2 weeks. And we did that. And our communications person this morning, she said, you know, I spent the weekend at my kid's lacrosse tournament. And she said, between games, she said, I was reading the book that Jim Jackson, my dad, wrote about starting Project Cure. And she said, I got my why back. And I was reminded again of the mission. And, you know, Chris, when I talk to CEOs of for-profit companies, they're really intrigued with this notion of how do you get 35,000 people to show up on a regular basis? I mean, I've got people who have worked with us for 30 years. I mean, they've been there as long or longer than I've been there. And they work every week, sometimes 30 to 40 hours a week. For 2 or 3 decades, right? And people are like, man, you know, we can't, we're having to give people signing bonuses and all this stuff. And I just asked him, I said, how much do you really focus in on your mission? I've got a friend here who's a doctor. He's a pediatric oncologist, which, you know, those are heroes in my book. If you're gonna treat little kids with cancer, good Lord. And we were talking about this over dinner one night, and he said, yeah, he said, our mission is, we turned 4-year-olds into 5-year-olds. And I thought, man, if you can't get that, you know, that's our job is to turn 4-year-olds into 5-year-olds. So at Project Cure, we just talk a lot about that whole mission and purpose. And we get people to come over from other countries. You know, we're headed to Washington, D.C. tomorrow night. We have an event with the ambassador from Ukraine, and they're hosting us at the Ukraine House in DC. And to be able to hear from her, what a difference. Or Mayor Klitschko, you know, that's the mayor of Kyiv, sent a little video the other day and said, this is what you guys mean to us on the front lines at Project Cure. Well, I'm going to take that message out and share that with everybody, right? So there's a thing that we can do. I love when you go out to Anschutz on their elevator doors, they have a picture. The whole elevator door is covered in a picture of somebody that they treated that either recovered from cancer or, you know, they faced some other debilitating condition. Maybe they lost a limb or something. And they not only survived, they're thriving now. And every time one of those doctors or nurses or physical therapist, whatever, gets on that elevator, every time one of those patients like me goes out there for my annual checkup and I get on that elevator, I'm reminded this is the mission of this hospital. And it's a pretty cool thing.
Yes, it is. It's a wonderful thing. You know, I understand that we have about $740 billion of medical waste in the U.S. Would you share a little bit about how you build a culture around a domestic excess problem while serving an international clients who make less than $1 a day?
Isn't that crazy? I mean, statistically, half the world's population, so we're edging up on 4 billion of the 8 billion people in the world who work 12 hours. And I'm not talking about people who don't have a job. I'm talking about people who are working hard. And they make $5 or less a day. There's 1.2 billion people who live on about $1 a day. And when they get sick and they go to the hospital, if they don't have any money, you know, moms have to buy their own gloves and they have to buy their own suture on the way in to deliver the baby. Well, you know, suture's still $4 a pack. And then mom's not going to make it. And that's, you know, our maternal mortality rate here is, you know, 7 out of 100,000 live births or something like that, which is going in the wrong direction here because of a lot of things. But over there, it's 800, 1,000, 1,500 as compared to 6 or 7, which is crazy. So when you start looking at that and think, wow, the only thing standing between that mom dying and that mom living is suture and clean gloves. And we have it here in the United States. I know we like to pick on medicine because the costs of our healthcare just keep going up so fast, but But you think about every industry has huge excess. Restaurants and food. You know, I've got a friend here in town who started an organization called We Don't Waste, and they go to restaurants and get all the stuff that didn't get served that night and go out and feed people who are hungry. When we all converted over from our really big televisions and we all wanted flat screen televisions, what do we do with all the old ones? Right? We got excess. Remember during the Obama administration, they had this thing, you know, cash for clunkers or whatever it was. You were supposed to take your perfectly good Range Rover and take it out to the junkyard, and they smashed it. And I'm like, that car still works. Why would you do that? So anyway, it's just kind of crazy what we do. The message that I try to send to our friends and around the world is that this isn't junk. You know, it's not like we're dumpster diving. This is really, really, really good stuff. It's just for one reason or another, we just have a lot of it. And I can't tell you right now how many hospitals, clinics, wholesalers are calling, and they overbought PPE. And they thought, oh, wow, look at this consumption rate. Well, consumption rate didn't hold. That's a mistake. This stuff is brand new. It's on pallets. I had a guy literally this morning, Chris, call and say, I have two semi-truck trailers full of nitrile gloves.
Wow.
Sterile surgical gloves. You can have them. I need to get them out of my warehouse. So, you know, we've just been so blessed. And you think about it, I mean, we've all got blessings in our lives that we can share with other people, regardless if it's, you know, taking a loaf of bread to the guy that lives next door, or, you know, helping out somebody else with something that we've got. And when you start thinking about that and it's a mindset, it really starts to change the way you live your life.
You bet. You know, I really appreciate the opportunity to get to visit with you today about all this, Doug. As a final question for you, is there anything you'd like to share with our listeners today before we close?
Well, we are growing like crazy, and we would love to have people get involved. Project Cure is in 7 cities right now with big distribution warehouses. We're in Denver, Phoenix, Nashville, Houston, Chicago, Philadelphia, and then during COVID, we stood up our 7th warehouse in Kansas City. I know that there are at least a dozen and a half other cities where Project Cure really needs to be. Houston is the biggest medical center in the world. They've got like 150 hospitals in Houston. Memorial Hermann chain alone has like 38 hospitals in Houston. Colorado's Front Range, I think we've got like 25 or 28, you know, from basically Cheyenne down to Pueblo, up over to Vail Valley, and the good work that those guys do over there. There's not very many. And we're shipping a semi-truck trailer out of Denver. Imagine what we could do in Dallas if, you know, 86 hospitals in Dallas. That's the same medical size as Chicago. You have 55 hospitals on the island in New York and Manhattan. 55 hospitals in Manhattan. And I can tell you that today there's excess product sitting around in warehouses or on a loading dock at a hospital somewhere. Dr. Jones left and Dr. Smith doesn't want to use Dr. Jones's surgery packs. Well, what are you going to do with it, friends? And we can go out there and we can grab that stuff, repurpose it. Project Cure raises money to ship. All the funding that we do is just the transaction, just to go out and get the stuff, warehouse it, process it, some insurance, and then the ocean freight to deliver it to the middle of wherever it was, Africa, Asia, Mongolia, South America, South Pacific, you know. And so that's kind of what we do. So we're looking for more volunteers. We run a thing called Cure Clinics, where we actually take medical practitioners and we do a little, you know, 7 to 10 day Doctors Without Borders type trip. And it's a great opportunity to really get out and rub shoulders with fellow medical professionals in other countries. And so anyway, I guess the answer, Chris, is there's a seat on this bus with these people's names on it. And it would just be great to have them get on and ride along with us. And let's just see where it goes.
That's fantastic, Doug. Thank you so much for your time today and for sharing how you've implemented the for-profit business strategies in a culture that is motivated by mission first. And we wish you the best as you go forward, and thank you again.
Well, thanks, Chris. I'm looking forward to seeing you at the next Denver Medical Study Group meeting. big fan of what you're doing and just happy to be a part of it. Thanks for the opportunity.
Well, we really appreciate your support.